Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Robert, today I wanted to talk about kind of an odd topic. So a few years back, I saw this weird claim in some book or article I was reading. I don't remember what it was now, but it was this castaway remark about the physicist Brian Greene, favorite of ours here.
Yeah,
right?
We talked about him on the show before, one of the co-founders of the World Science Festival.
Right. Mentioning the possibility that scientists could create a universe in lab conditions. It's kind of an odd thing to say, so obviously I was intrigued, but I didn't really follow up on it at the time. It stuck with me, though. I kept thinking, is that really possible, or is this just some funny physicist thought experiment? Is it one of those jokes that gets worked out in math? And recently I became aware of a new book by a science writer with a PhD in physics named Zia Murali addressing exactly this question. So the book is called A Big Bang in a Little Room, The Quest to Create New Universes by Basic Books. It came out this year. And this book addresses exactly that question of whether you can actually create a universe under laboratory conditions, not just as a joke, but in reality. And if you could do that, what would that capability mean for us and our civilization? So that's the question I wanted us to look at today. Is this really something we could do? And if so, how would you do it?
Yeah, because this is such a huge question, because we're asking a question about, you know, basic cosmology. Like we're talking about creating a new universe without really having it completely boiled down how our universe came into being.
Totally. I mean, and of course that presents a very big problem for anybody wanting to create a universe in the lab is like, we're not even sure how the one universe we're aware of came into being. We know a lot of things about its early history, but we don't know the ultimate question of its origin.
Yeah. And in terms of sort of God complex Frankenstein aspirations for the human species, I mean, we're still working on some of the much smaller stuff.
Right.
Creating a rational animal out of spare parts. That alone is enough of a challenge without getting into the idea of an entire universe that springs up at the snap of a fingers.
Yeah, is a civilization obsessed with the ethics of whether to create robot soldiers and sex robots really ready to make a whole universe.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, but people have obviously been obsessed with the origins of the universe since a long time before science had anything useful to say about it, right? I mean, we have scientific cosmology now, and this is a thing that's really just emerged pretty much in the last century. But our myths from ancient times are full of these beautiful creation from chaos or creation from the void stories, which envision a universe coming into focus out of empty space, nothingness, or some kind of other uninhabited primordial condition, often like an ocean or a sea or ice or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, we've been asking the same questions about our universe as long as we've inhabited it, really, as long as we've had the cognitive ability to just sort of gaze up at the stars and wonder what we're looking at and then how it all came into being. And one thing I find interesting about all of these creation out of darkness myths is that it seems to line up with our individual experience of arising from unconsciousness, of waking from unconsciousness.
Yeah.
And certainly there are plenty of creation myths that add this additional layer of anthropomorphism where the universe is made from a body or is shaped like a body. Our understanding of the cosmos is like lined up with the shape of the human body. Therefore, it makes sense that we would take that personal experience of the universe and try to, apply it to everything within it.
Yeah, there are lots of classic myths. I like that you point that out. I think that's a really interesting idea about it mirroring our expansion into the world from a place of darkness and unknown. You know, before you were born, it's not like you were sitting around waiting to be born. You just didn't exist, or you at least weren't aware of anything as far as you know.
Yeah.
As far as you can remember. Now, for all those past lives, I may have been kings and sorcerers and wonderful creatures. Never mind. That's a discussion for another day.
No, but you're right. But for the most part, in the beginning, there was darkness.
Yeah.
Like, that's our personal experience of reality. And it makes sense that we would apply that to the cosmos as a whole.
Now, later in the episode, of course, we're going to look at the science of the real earliest moments of the universe, how the universe came to be the way it is, and how you might create universes in the lab if such an idea has any merit at all. But I thought we should actually look at a few of these mythological realizations about the origins of the universe, because they are so fun and so fascinating. And they also give you a peek into the minds of the ancient people who pondered this question without any real information to draw on.
Yeah. And plus, these will be fun to come back to as well when we start cracking open some of these scientific views of the birth of our universe.
There's one piece of Norse mythology literature that I wanted to look at that has a great creation out of chaos story in it. And this is a piece of Norse mythology literature called the Gylfaginning. And so I just want to read this section from an English translation. It's got this king, and this king is talking to these powerful beings that are answering questions for him. And he's asking these probing questions about the universe. So this king named Gangleri asked, "How were things wrought ere the races were and the tribes of men increased? Then said Har, the streams called ice waves, those which were so long come from the fountain heads that the yeasty venom upon them had hardened like the slag that runs out of the fire. These then became ice, and when the ice halted and ceased to run, then it froze over above. But the drizzling rain that rose from the venom congealed to rime, and the rime increased, frost over frost, each over the other, even into Gningagap, the yawning void." Then another one speaks, Jafnhar. "Gningagap, which faced toward the northern quarter, became filled with heaviness and masses of ice and rime, and from within drizzling rain and gusts, but the southern part of the yawning void was lighted by those sparks and glowing masses which flew out of the Muspelheim." And then a third great ruler speaks and says, quote, "Just as cold arose out of Niflheim and all terrible things, so also all that looked toward Muspelheim became hot and glowing, and the yawning void was as mild as windless air, and when the breath of heat met the rime so that it melted and dripped, life was quickened from the yeast drops by the power of that which sent the heat and became a man's form, and that man is named Ymir, but the rime giants call him Argelimir.
Oh man, I really like the idea of the yeasty venom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's this freezing and melting process, which gives rise to the order of the universe in the Norse mythology idea.
And is there a sense of fermentation there as well? Just with the couple of mentions of yeast makes me, there's something
that like
lost
beer
there,
but is central to their vision of the cosmos. It's frozen beer and venom coming to life, freezing and melting.
What could be more Nordic than that? All right. Well, I have one here that also it touches on similar territory. Actually, I have a couple I'm going to read here, and these are both from Chinese mythology.
Okay.
In Chinese myth, this is one of those areas where you have multiple different origin stories for the universe that kind of make the rounds depending on where you're going in Chinese history and who's doing the talking.
So it's not going to be like a single codified myth.
Right. And you see this in a number of different faiths. You also see this in Hinduism, as we'll get to in a bit. But this one in particular comes from the 4th century BCE. One of a few different Chinese cosmology myths related in Anne Birrell's Chinese Mythology and Introduction, and she points out that these cosmologies are essentially authorless. But I really like this one because it describes the primordial darkness as moist and the same in a way that reminds one of a singularity. In the beginning of the eternal past, when all was the ultimate sameness in vast empty space. Empty and the same, all was one, one eternally at rest, moist, wet, and murky dim, before there were darkness and light.
Oh, that is great. Moist, wet, and murky dim.
Yeah.
But also I like this idea of the original chaos of creation being homogeneity,
mm-hmm.
that there is a lack of division between things.
Yes.
And that actually – and so that implies the emergence of order or the creation of recognizable objects and structure to the universe is in fact a cleaving of sameness into difference.
Yes. Yeah, and that'll come back again when we get to a couple of Hindu examples. Now, there's another Chinese example I want to hit there, and this is from Huainan Zhu, an early Han work by Han Dynasty prince Lu'an. So I love the mystery of the words in this translation.
Okay, let's hear it.
Before heaven and earth had formed, there was a shapeless dark expanse, a gaping mass. Thus it was called the Great Glory. The way, Tao, first came from vacant space. Vacant space gave birth to the cosmos, and cosmos gave birth to the breath, and the breath had its limits.
Had its limits?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
And after this part, yin and yang come into play. So you get sort of the duality that is central to Taoism becomes, an important force in the continuing formation of the universe.
So there are sort of limits imposed by counterposing opposites.
Yes. Here's another bit from this. Long ago, before heaven and earth existed, there were only images but no forms, and all was dark and obscure, a vast desolation, a misty expanse, and nothing knew where its own portals were. There were two gods born out of chaos who wove the sky and designed the earth. And these two gods are the yin and yang forces.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Again, here with the yin and yang forces, it's like we're seeing a division or a distinction as the act of establishing creation.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned the Hindu models earlier, so I do want to touch on a couple of these. So too often we see this trope of just order out of chaos, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Hinduism places a value on both properties. So if you go back to early Vedic ideas about the creation of the universe, you have this Vedic creator deity, Prajapati. And Prajapati strove to make a universe that could contain both order and chaos, so the energies of the devas and the asuras. So the first creation was too orderly and seemingly too boring, too uniform. So there's just too much sameness.
It's like a fascist universe.
Yeah.
So everything must obey.
Yeah, and then he creates a second universe, but this one's too chaotic, too fragmented. But the third was just right.
the Goldilocks universe. Just enough chaos for you.
Just enough chaos,
just enough to be
order.
Interesting.
Yeah, but the thing is this too, even though he essentially gets it right, there still has to be regular intervals of destruction and renewal.
Okay.
And that's something, of course, when we start talking about some of our modern models for the creation of the universe.
Yeah,
we get into this a bit, the idea that there's an expansion and then a contraction of the universe.
Well, in a lot of these things, and this is not to say that these myths were actually on to something scientifically. Mm-hmm. I think this is probably largely coincidence or just has to do with the depth of our ideas about how order and chaos work. But some of these do mirror modern scientific theories. Like one thing I was thinking was about the division or distinction model about establishing the order of the universe. This sort of mirrors the idea of these grand unified theories in physics, where in physics you've got the forces of the universe, aside from gravity, you've got the three forces, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and the electromagnetic force. And the grand unified theories propose that at some point in the past, way in the early universe, these were one single unified force, mm-hmm. and the universe sort of comes to become the thing it is as these forces separate into distinct forces that have their own actions and their own mediating particles.
Yeah, so maybe Prajapati was onto something. Now, Prajapati becomes associated with the god Brahma in the post-Vedic age. But this is, again, a situation where with Hinduism, like with Chinese mythology, there's no singular creation story. There are many. And again, there's no singular creation in Hinduism, but rather periodic cycles of creation and destruction, and also innumerable universes. So in our universe, for instance, there's this idea in Hinduism that it begins with a vast ocean and a serpent sleeps on its surface and Vishnu sleeps in the coils of the serpent and a lotus sprouts out from his navel and within it is Brahma. And he's urged to meditate on the nature of his coming creation and finally splits the lotus into three forms, making the heavens, the sky, and earth. Everything else stems from this.
Yet again, we get a division of the universe into its parts.
Yeah. And just a few more quick examples here. So in ancient Egypt, you had Nun or Nu, the primeval waters, the ocean of chaos, boundless, dark, and stormy.
Nice.
And in Greek mythology, we have chaos personified, chaos, the being.
Mm-hmm.
So this is from the Theogony of Hesiod from around 700 BCE.
Okay.
Verily at the first chaos came to be, but next wide-bosomed earth, the ever-sure foundations of all the deathless ones who hold the peaks of snowy Olympus and dim Tartarus in the depth of the wide-pathed earth, and Eros, love, fairest among the deathless gods, who unnerves the limbs and overcomes the mind and wise counsels of all gods and all men within them. From chaos came forth Erebus and black night, but of night were born Aether and Day, whom she conceived and bare from union in love with Erebus.
Okay, so this one to me sounds more like some of these like Babylonian creation myths mm-hmm. and stuff where the forces of the universe are personified as creatures, monsters, or people.
Yeah, very much so. The direct personification. Though, I mean, you can say that the personification is maybe layered on top of just the idea of these forces interacting.
You know, I wonder when people spoke these myths in the ancient world to, you know, to the extent that they were believing them to be correct explanations of the origins of the universe, did they think of them metaphorically or did they think of them as literal? Like, did they literally think there was a person chaos or did the ancient Greeks understand that this was just a way of helping to visualize some more abstract process?
Well, and of course, you also have to think about the fact that so many of these different mythologies and folk tales and no matter what level to what level they're personified or just related as forces interacting, you know, they're probably going to vary depending on who's telling them and who they're telling them to.
Right.
Like I can imagine a situation where someone might look back on a like a you know, an animated feature about how germs work that we created for children in the 1970s, and if that's all you had to go on, you might say, oh well, they thought that germs had little cartoon faces and became angry.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm asking. Yeah.
So I don't know, but I could see it going either way. You know, you could certainly imagine this being the version you told everyone, but everyone might have been in agreement that, yeah, these were not real people. This is just a fun way of remembering these interactions and a fun way of passing them on.
Are you an ancient historian? Do you have insights into how people process these myths and to what extent they were believed to be literal? If so, let us know. I want to know more about that. One last myth we should look at. Let's look at the book of Genesis, the Hebrew Bible. I love the Genesis creation story. It's very beautifully written. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Oh, so good. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness, and called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day.
It's great. I mean, the poetry of it is lovely. Now, it's definitely an account in which God or a creator entity shows up from somewhere, and it's like, what we got here? A bunch of darkness. Let's do something with this. So there's nothing about God emerging from that darkness. It's just you wake up. It's like starting a movie. You're in the room. Here's God in the darkness.
Yeah, here's your protagonist.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny that, I mean, all of these myths really start you with something, because what else could they do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got to have some kind of instigating event or matter in the story, or there cannot be a story.
Yeah.
And that question also translates onto real questions about the cosmology of the universe. So, mm-hmm. you know, there are always these questions of the infinite regress of causes. You know, does the universe in some sense require a primary explanation? Like, even if you manage to do away with all kinds of other explanations, like, where do the principles that govern your physics come from? And we can look at more of that as we go on. One interesting fact I wanted to note about creation mythologies: there are actually religions without creation mythologies. One example would be Jainism or Jainism. You know, this mm-hmm. is found, I believe there's a lot of Jainism practiced in India.
Yeah.
And they reject the idea of a creator deity or a creation event. Their religious cosmology is just of an eternally existing universe.
Yeah.
Anyway, I find that really interesting, but I also find it interesting how rare that is. But this throws up a dichotomy. The origin of the cosmos, I think, is a necessarily fascinating thing to contemplate, because you know that no matter which theory is true, one half of this dichotomy is correct. Either the universe began to exist, or it did not begin to exist. If it did not begin to exist, this implies there's an infinite past, something that feels just impossible to imagine, right? That the past goes on forever into mm-hmm. backward time. How can you picture that? It seems somehow so counterintuitive, it's almost self-contradictory.
Well, that is, at least for modern individuals who have
a typical
view of time.
Yeah.
You know, we think of our life as the story from cradle to the grave. We think of everything as this kind of story or movie in which we're the prime character.
Right.
I could certainly see that, you know, a person from an older culture in which time is seen as cyclical, and there's, you know, everything comes back around, and individuals are only important insofar as they, you know, they shadow some figure from the past or some movement from the past. I could see that view of time lining up more easily with an idea of the infinite past and future.
Well, a cyclical eternity is an interesting thing to contemplate, because mm-hmm. that's a little bit different than just like an eternally past regressive infinity.
Right.
You know what I mean? Something that cycles back and forth between the beginning and the end forever versus something that just goes back forever.
Because certainly you still have, even in that scenario, you still have causation.
Yeah.
You still have events causing things to happen. And I dare say you're still going to have 5-year-olds who are asking questions about why things are the way they are.
Uh-huh.
And you have to answer them one way or another. Now, one thing that comes to mind is in the absence of a certain cultural story that you're supposed to roll out, when someone says, "Hey, when the kid asks, where did the universe come from?" and you say, "Oh, well, God created it," or there used to be this moist darkness, and it rolls right. out from there.
I'm going with the moist darkness from now on, by the way.
Yeah, I like that one, but it seems like it would be ideal to not only have some story to tell them, but a story that, if it doesn't have actual truth in it about the actual origins of the universe, then at least it has some level of relatability to it. There's some level of truth to it, you know?
You mean just some level of truth as in applicability to your life? You can get something out of it, even if it's not a correct description of the cosmos.
Like it explains something about the interaction of forces within your world or within your worldview.
Yeah, sure. I wanted to hit the other half of that dichotomy, okay. Right? So imagine the past is not eternal in that reality did begin to exist at some point. There's a limit on the past history of existence. That seems to me about equally implausible and counterintuitive. How can you picture that? Like it's no wonder, I think, that religious traditions are obsessed with the origin of the universe. It's the ultimate explanation question. And because of this dichotomy, no matter what the answer to it is, that answer is a total mystery. It commands awe. And you know that one of them has to be correct.
Yeah. I mean, this kind of gets down to the basic nature of humans as having this ability to plan beyond their own life, lifespan, you know? And in doing so, not only are they planning beyond their own lifespan, but they're also trying to figure out how we got to where we are with previous generations. So humans have kind of trapped themselves. Like part of our survival technique is to view time as existing beyond our life and before it. Mm-hmm. But you kind of end up wrapping in beginnings and endings in that, right? I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, there's no ape cosmology for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
But one of those reasons is that the ape is perfectly content to live within the confines of its life, even with just the confines of its moment.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
Like our reckoning of our own mortality and the finitude of our life sort of forces us to look beyond in a way that other animals presumably don't.
Yeah. Maybe I'm gazing too deep into the void on that one, but.
No, keep gazing. Eventually you'll penetrate the moist darkness with your eyes. Now, of course, scientists have spent years putting together a totally different picture of how the universe came to be, and this is going to be a picture based on verified physics. And so I think that's what we should look at when we come back from the break.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Now, obviously, we've got to look at what scientists have discovered about how our universe came to exist. You might be thinking, of course, the Big Bang, right? That's how the universe came to exist. But I think this is a slight misconception about what the Big Bang is, and one of the most common misconceptions about mainstream science today. The Big Bang theory, I would posit, doesn't really claim to explain where the universe came from. It describes the history of the universe. Mm-hmm. It says that the universe began in an incredibly hot, dense state, and it has been expanding and cooling for about 13.8 billion years. Now, the Big Bang theory is widely accepted by physicists as the correct explanation of the history of the universe, and the evidence for it is very strong. One piece of evidence comes from looking at the current expansion rate of the universe and tracing it backward in time, which appears to indicate a shrinking of space toward a central point of incredible density. But another major piece of evidence is the cosmic microwave background radiation. So this is something we can see today. According to the Big Bang theory, we'd predict that in the early universe, for a long time, matter was too dense to allow light to shine through. So can you picture this universe? It's a universe that's almost like a cloud of opaque material. It's so dense with particles like neutrons, protons, electrons, positrons, neutrinos. Everything's crammed into this tight space that electromagnetic radiation like light couldn't penetrate it. Charged electrons were so dense that they would constantly scatter any light that was trying to move around in the universe. And so the universe was opaque at that point. But then the universe started to cool and to allow electrons to pair up with protons and neutrons to make our friends the atoms, electrically neutral atoms. And this happened at a time about 380,000 years after the beginning of the Big Bang. And this allowed the light to pass through. So suddenly radiation was visible throughout the universe. If you can imagine this moment in time, There's an opaque, dark universe crammed with hot, dense matter, and suddenly it's shining with light.
Well, this brings to mind the Norse example that you read earlier.
Oh, yeah?
Where everything begins to sort of twinkle at one point.
Oh, yeah.
Darkness. Yeah.
So this sudden shining of light, this afterglow of radiation, is still visible today through our telescopes, and it's known as the cosmic microwave background radiation, and it's a great piece of evidence for the correctness of the Big Bang theory to explain the expansion of our universe. But as we've said, the Big Bang theory doesn't actually go all the way back, right? It picks up with that hot, dense state of the earliest moments of our universe. So where did that hot, dense state come from?
Yeah, you have to approach the question with the mind of a scientist or the mind of a five-year-old and say, oh, well, what came before that?
Exactly. So what explains its existence? Is there a more fundamental structure or law guiding the cosmos? Obviously, we are going to look at that question, but also it's worth noting that since the 1980s, it's important to pay attention to the fact that the Big Bang model has been very much enriched by the development of what's known as cosmic inflation theory. Inflation theory is too dense and too difficult to explain all the mechanics of right here. It would sort of take over the episode, I think. Maybe we can tackle it someday in the future if we're feeling ambitious and brave. But I will stick with the simplest summary I can for today. Inflation theory says that in the earliest split second of the universe, this is before the universe is a second old. In fact, it's about 10 to the negative 34 seconds old, which is a tiny, tiny amount of time. The rate of the expansion of the universe suddenly dramatically increases. So the universe is expanding, and for a short time in that first second, it begins inflation, which means it expands way, way faster than it was expanding anyway. And it got much faster, and then at a certain point slowed down again, and then we have the regular expansion rate of the universe we observe today. Now, the really surprising thing about that inflation period, however, is that it looks like it has the power to conjure matter into existence as the bubble space-time region expands. So during this inflation period, you suddenly get particles popping into existence from the space-time that's expanding. And the physicist Alan Guth, who's known as one of the main people behind inflation theory, has joked about this finding, quote, "In the context of inflationary cosmology, it's fair to say that the universe is the ultimate free lunch." The free lunch there being the matter that makes up our bodies and the stars.
Wow, you know, this inflation period is really this is an area of a lot of possibility for science, because this is also where you get various arguments about how fast can something travel in the universe.
Oh, sure.
If it's not something in the universe as much as a piece of the universe, like something like a ship within a bubble of space-time.
Right. We know from relativity theory that no object with mass in the universe, no information can travel faster than the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible. But it turns out that does not apply to the universe or space-time region itself,
right,
according to inflation, which I should note is not considered quite proven.
Right.
There appears to be a lot of good evidence for inflation, and I think it's widely accepted as mainstream science by physical cosmologists today. But it's not like – it's not a lock. It's not a solidly proven theory. It just looks like a really good one.
And if one were to personify all of these forces, you could say, well, the universe is a god, and things within the universe are mere mortals.
Right.
And therefore are not bound by the same rules.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I got distracted. No, what I meant to say was that under inflation, the universe expands faster than the speed of light.
Yeah.
While things in the universe can't go faster than the speed of light, the universe itself can. But to come back to this question of ultimate causes, the ultimate origins or explanation of everything in the universe, where did it all come from? Nobody really knows for sure the answer to that. I mean, there have been people working on this from a scientific perspective. Physicists like Alexander Vilenkin and Lawrence Krauss, they've put forward these models where, to best explain it, sort of the naked laws of quantum mechanics acting on no original quantity of matter can give rise to space-time, which then undergoes inflation to expand and create the universe. Does that make any sense? I know it's hard to picture, but essentially they're working from a model where what you've got is quantum vacuum. You've got the laws of quantum mechanics, and they don't need anything to work with. They just, acting on themselves, generate space-time and matter.
It's kind of, it seems to me like one of the difficulties in picturing all of this, especially for someone who's not just really immersed in the physics of it, is that we live in a world of bread and we're trying to understand the batter, right?
Yeah.
The dough, if you will, I guess.
Or we're trying to understand, no, we live in a world of bread and we're trying to understand the wheat. Not really the wheat. We're trying to understand where the wheat came from, but the wheat comes from atoms. There's no analogy really that works. It's almost as if we live in a world of bread, and what we discovered is that there are physics models you can put together where the instructions or the recipe for baking bread creates the flour and the eggs and the water and stuff that you need to bake the bread with.
Oh, see, we're going into the deep end in this episode for sure.
So yeah, there's a lot of crazy counterintuitive stuff in looking at the physical cosmology of the universe. And like I said, nobody knows what the correct model of the ultimate origins of the cosmos are, or at least as far back as it would be possible for us to understand. But there are also these other interesting models of sort of the ultimate fundamental nature of the universe. There's this model of loop quantum gravity and the Big Crunch. Under loop quantum gravity, space-time is made up of one-dimensional threads called loops. And these loops are spontaneously created by the laws of quantum mechanics, yet again, like I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So you've got the laws of quantum mechanics, and they just make this stuff. And then this stuff makes up the fabric of our universe. And loop quantum gravity implies a cyclical expansion and contraction of the universe occurring eternally. So every time you have a big bang, the universe expands and then leads to an eventual contraction and crunching back down to a singularity at the end, going back and forth eternally, kind of like our Vedic myths, right?
Yeah, yeah. This a lot of commentators have pointed out that this idea of continual destruction and rebirth lines up with the Big Crunch idea fairly closely. It's essentially the idea that the universe is a boomerang video, shared on Instagram, where you can just watch it go back and forth, back and forth.
That's
until you lose your mind.
Worst metaphor you've ever used on this show.
I make a lot of boomerangs these days.
It's like a dog tongue whipping back and forth forever. No, it shows you what I look at on Instagram. Dog tongues forever.
Now, so that's your handle.
Exactly.
Dog tongues forever on Instagram. Follow Joe.
Forever. At dog tongues forever. Hashtag dog tongues forever. Obviously, now for some people in this ultimate origins question, we should acknowledge for a lot of people put a religious answer in here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether that involves ice waves and cosmic venom and moist darkness or some kind of supernatural immaterial mind who decides to create a universe. A lot of people want to go in that direction, and that to them, they feel provides an explanation. To me, not to degrade that as an answer, but it seems like a different kind of explanation than the scientific explanations. It's not dealing in exactly the same kind of, trying to find precise terminology and to specify causal relationships and to mathematically, quantize what's involved.
Well, I mean, ultimately, all you can do is create some sort of visual metaphor for this just utterly unknowable time. Like, just the idea of there's God in the darkness and he's alone.
Right.
And kind of bored. Like, we can sort of imagine that. We can imagine somebody being alone in the darkness, sort of this idea of just sitting there with your eyes closed in bed and you haven't woken up, you haven't opened your eyes and moved on with your day yet.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems it's a more narrative kind of explanation than a causal law or theory explanation.
Yeah, it's essentially you're saying, let's just tie a nice little narrative bow here and we're done until a 5-year-old or a scientist asks questions.
Right. But here's maybe the weirdest alternative. What if the origin of our universe is that it came from another universe that existed before it? Not in a cyclical universe model where you've got the permanent, expansion and contraction, but what if this universe was created in a laboratory in another universe? Would such a thing be possible? And that's what we're going to look at now. That's the meat of this episode.
All right. Well, let's take another break. And when we come back, we'll ask the question, could we create a universe? And if we could, what does that even mean? What are the limitless ramifications of that act?
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. Picture this, it's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Okay, so from here on out, when we're exploring the concept of creating baby universes in the laboratory, I want to be very clear that we're venturing into the speculative realm. None of these universe creation hypotheses are proven to be achievable, but I do think it'll be fun to explore the possibilities that have been explored by scientists. So it's time to go back to Zia Morali's book, the book that I mentioned at the top of the episode, The Big Bang in a Little Room, or The Quest to Create New Universes. So what does she propose in her book? Well, she explores this possibility put forward by many scientists, including people like Alan Guth and Andre Lind and others over the years, that you could perhaps create a universe in the laboratory. And it's based on the theory of inflation, which, as we mentioned earlier, is not necessarily totally proven, but it's a widely accepted theory in cosmology today.
Again, this is particles popping into existence, right?
Yeah. In this rapid expansion rate of space-time triggered by what's known as a false vacuum, you create these spaces that expand rapidly, and they create particles as they expand, sort of churning a universe into existence.
Okay.
But anyway, the idea is, as Alan Guth and many others over the years have hypothesized, it might be possible to create a universe with the use of an extremely powerful particle accelerator like the Large Hadron Collider, but probably of an even much higher energy than that. So Morali explains one currently favored hypothetical process in her book. And in this process, you would need to start with a particle called a monopole. Now, a monopole is a hypothetical elementary particle that's defined by the fact that it has, as its name implies, only one magnetic pole.
Hmm.
Now, what? You might be thinking, like, wait a minute. Only one magnetic pole. So you've played with magnets before, right? To picture a bar magnet, north and south pole. You put the north and south poles of two magnets together and they'll attract. Try to put the north and north poles together of two magnets and they will repel one another. But you can't cut your bar magnet in half and create a bar magnet with only a north pole, right? If you cut it in half, in fact, what you'll do is create two magnets,
right,
with a north pole and a south pole each. So how could you create something that only had one pole? Like, can you imagine a planet with only a north pole and no south pole?
No, I mean, the most obvious answer would be cut a planet in half, but you still have, there's still going to be a top and a bottom. Like, it's still a three-dimensional object.
Yeah,
in
then
space.
You just generate a new north pole and
right,
south pole. Yeah. So it's hard to picture, but physics predicts that these particles are out there. So could we get our hands on a monopole if you need one for this experiment? Well, it's hard to say. Like I said, there are good reasons based in physics to think that they do exist, but we've never found any naturally occurring in the universe. So maybe we're totally misguided. There are no monopoles out there. And we've looked for them. We've looked in cosmic rays. Are they shooting across the universe in cosmic rays? We've looked in the oceans. We've looked embedded in ancient rocks. We've looked at moon rocks to see if they have monopoles in them. And so far, zilch. But we have created synthetic monopole quasi-particles, they're called, in this human-made crystal called spin ice. Morali, she talks about this in her book. And this seems to indicate that monopoles are possible in nature, even if we haven't found any yet. So what are some potential ideas for how we could get one? Well, maybe you could make them in a particle collider like the Large Hadron Collider. In fact, the Large Hadron Collider, they've got a detector in place to try to find out if it has accidentally generated any monopoles. Or you could maybe catch one flying through the universe, and you'd use what you'd use to catch it is a squid, not a biosquid.
I'm thinking of the big, there was the show, was it, Silverhawks, I think. Remember this?
I've never seen this. What is this?
It was kind of like Thundercats, except in space. Mm-hmm. And there was the bad guy, the Mumra of this show, turned into a big robot guy who rode a space squid. But that's not what we're talking about here.
Well, I got to look this up now. Yeah. But no, this is a squid, which means a superconducting quantum interference device. It's an acronym.
It's probably going to be an easy way to catch it.
Yeah. And so it's like a cage that is tuned so as to catch an object with a single directional magnetic charge. And so it, because of the single directional magnetic charge of the monopole, if it passes into this cage, it should trigger detectable current in the device, get trapped into the device, and let you know that you've trapped a monopole inside that we could harvest.
All right, so you have a monopole at this point. Let's say you've found it. It exists. You have one in your hand or in your, you know, vacuum tube or whatever. What do you do with it?
You probably don't want it in your hand. You want it captured, mm-hmm, and you put it into your high energy particle collider with some other massive particles. And then you get them going. You accelerate these and you accelerate them and accelerate them up to near the speed of light to increase their energy. And then you smash them together. And mathematically, from the properties of the monopole, we can predict that if you transfer enough energy to the monopole by smashing it in the particle collider, it will probably begin, at least according to this theory, to undergo inflation like the early universe did, or at least like we think it did, which would rend space-time itself, creating a tunneling wormhole into a new bubble of space-time. And this is what's sometimes called a baby universe, a sort of a new space-time that pinches off like a blister from our other space-time, and it would begin rapidly expanding. It would create inflation within this region. Now, you might be scared, like, oh, so if it's inflating, wouldn't this inflate inside the particle collider, take over the lab, maybe destroy, mm-hmm, the Earth?
Like, suck us all into this baby universe bubble?
It doesn't sound good to have a universe expanding inside your universe.
No. I mean, unless you just call it a baby universe, and then that somehow sanitizes the whole thing. but everything, all the other terms we're throwing out here, like wormhole, are kind of terrifying.
Yeah, but that's not what would happen, because it's a separate space-time region, mm-hmm, so it can expand out to universe-sized proportions without actually touching anything in our universe. What we would see supposedly in our universe, if this process is possible, is we would see what looks like a mini black hole.
So these are when you occasionally see sort of semi-scandalous science headlines, they're talking about the LHC could create miniature black holes. This is what they're referring to?
It's slightly different,
okay,
but similar. the Large Hadron Collider could potentially, as far as we know, maybe create many black holes. We haven't found any in it yet. Mm-hmm. But if it could create them, there is no reason to be alarmed about these. There's no reason to think that they would suck in the Earth or anything like that. Physicists have done the math. These mini black holes are going to dissipate, and they're not going to harm our universe.
And they might be delicious. We don't know. Now, and then, of course, the other key thing is that if you're creating a baby universe, that's a baby universe. There aren't going to be any, deadly cosmic elder gods in there. No Todash darkness. It's all new.
Well,
right?
You don't know, because it could be full of cosmic elder gods. It could be full of Todash darkness, because it's going to be its own universe. It can evolve however it wants.
Oh, okay.
So it could evolve creatures like us. It could evolve Klingons, a universe made entirely of Klingons. I mean, it could evolve the Todash Dark.
Ah, now, of course, there's the whole issue of time, but that gets a little bit sticky, to say the least, right? When you're talking about space-time in that bubble.
Oh, yeah. I mean, time is very odd if you try to take the perspective of looking at the universe from outside. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is another problem that physicists have often looked at. It seems that time is a very real factor of our universe. It's, considered the fourth dimension of space-time. It appears that things happen in time in an ordered sequence, but there are also reasons to think mathematically, if you just do the equations, it looks like if you were able to look at the universe from outside, it should be static in mm-hmm. terms of, like, it shouldn't evolve. It should be just an object.
All right. So, you would be looking at all time within that universe,
yeah.
If you were looking at it from the outside. I mean, it's kind of crazy, because you would be essentially looking at the universe as a god. You would be looking at it as the all-knowing, all-existing being that created it, even if you created it by accident in your science lab.
Well, one of the bittersweet ironies of creating a universe in the laboratory is that we really wouldn't have any way to look inside it.
Mm-hmm.
We just wouldn't have access to that universe. So we'd see this little black hole, tiny mini black hole, that's the portal of a wormhole to this new inflating universe. Eventually we would see the black hole dissipate over time.
Uh-huh.
It would lose particles through tiny Hawking radiation, and it would eventually disappear from our end. But what that would actually signify is that it's closing off the wormhole that connects our two universes, and then that universe is its own thing. And it's just separate from us, and we can't get to. You can't get there from here.
And whatever's going on inside there, it's just, you just have to guess. Like,
right.
Is there sentient life in there? Maybe. Maybe not. And if there is, then is it good? Are they having a good time in there? Are they having a pretty lousy time in there?
I mean, that's something we should look at in a minute here,
yeah,
when we discuss the possible ethics of creating universes. Now, I should real quick address the question. There's been a lot of hypotheticals in describing this,
yes,
this process, right? Could you actually do this? Like, how plausible is this process? Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that it's not involving anything that's like pure fantasy, but it also is counting on a lot of ifs.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if we capture a monopole, if we're able to achieve this process, if the interpretation of inflation is correct, all these ifs get factored in, and your probability kind of goes down each time you add in another if into the equation. So could you do this? It's tough to say. I mean, it's an interesting speculation. But we shouldn't, you shouldn't walk away from this episode with the idea, yes, we can create baby universes in the lab. I think mm-hmm. it's still a big open question. In fact, I read in Morali's book, she talks about how Alan Guth, one of the authors of inflation theory, he's gone back and forth about this over the years, about the plausibility of creating baby universes in the lab. At first, he was one of the original physicists to postulate it. Then he got pessimistic about it. Then he became more open to it again. And so he's gone back and forth on that. Other physicists have too. There's stuff that makes it look more plausible and then maybe makes it look less plausible. And it's been almost like a cyclical universe of plausibility and doubt expanding back and forth.
But also a great example of the basic scientific approach that we've touched on many times in this show, that even the individual who proposes this and is a proponent of it is going to question it and doubt it.
Yeah, if they're being a responsible scientist,
yeah,
sure, they should be skeptical about their own pet theories.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, as we mentioned in getting into this topic, if this process is indeed possible, another if there, so in the speculative realm, in the world where we just accept that this is possible, we're faced with an intriguing question. Is that us? Are we the baby universe that was made in the particle accelerator of some alien science lab?
Yeah. Just as a complete accident. Like the entire, our entire universe from beginning to end is just the blink of an eye to this, this greater universe beyond ours.
Yeah. And of course, that also implies, was their universe created as a baby universe in a particle accelerator in a lab in another alien universe? And then it's particle accelerators in an alien lab all the way down.
Yeah. And then you end up in the same scenario saying, well, what was the first universe?
Right.
What was that like? And then where did that come from? And then you're asking yourself, is there a beginning or an end to anything? Or is it just this infinite dark ocean?
Okay, but let's be skeptics for a minute and say, you know, there are a lot of ifs involved in this baby universe creation scenario. Let's go on the safe side and say we're probably not going to be able to do that.
Okay.
Is there any other way to create a universe, to create a universe with beings in it apart from creating a different inflating space-time? Well, what about simulating a universe?
Oh, yeah. I imagine there have been a number of listeners out there who've been like shouting into their MP3 player, the Matrix, this is the Matrix, right?
Exactly right. So a different but related argument, we live in a computer simulation. And in fact, there's this famous now article by the Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom called Are We Living in a Computer Simulation? It was from 2003, and this article has proved incredibly it has taken hostage many minds in philosophy departments around the world, saying, you know, look, here are the odds. Well, actually, you know what? I should just read it's the main summary of its argument. Okay. So Bostrom writes the following in this often excerpted quote. Many works of science fiction, as well as some forecasts by serious technologists and futurologists, predict that enormous amounts of computing power will be available in the future. Let us suppose for a moment that these predictions are correct. One thing that later generations might do with their super powerful computers is run detailed simulations of their forebears, or of people like their forebears. Because their computers would be so powerful, they could run a great many such simulations. Suppose that these simulated people are conscious, as they would be if simulations were sufficiently fine-grained, and if a certain quite widely accepted position in the philosophy of mind is correct. Then it could be the case that the vast majority of minds like ours do not belong to the original race, but rather to people simulated by the advanced descendants of an original race. It is then possible to argue that, if this were the case, we would be rational to think that we are likely among the simulated minds rather than among the original biological ones. Therefore, if we don't think that we are currently living in a computer simulation, we are not entitled to believe that we would have descendants who will run lots of such simulations of their forebears.
Ah, he kind of catches us in the logic there, and it makes a certain amount of sense, right?
Well, a lot of people have taken this to mean, okay, we're living in a computer simulation. I actually think the other half of his dilemma is the much more logical one. I think I sort of accept the dilemma. He's saying, like, either we can't make these simulations, or it's more likely to think we're living in one. I think the answer is we probably can't make these simulations.
Yeah. But the argument is sound the other way, to say that if this is the kind of thing that we will one day be able to do and will one day want to do,
yeah,
then who is to say that is not the current reality?
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. So I think where we get to is the problems with the plausibility of running a simulation of a universe. Mm-hmm. Think about it. If you're trying to create a computer program to simulate a universe, could you generate the laws of physics for the entire universe on a computer? Like, you couldn't really create quantum effects on a classical computer, so you'd need a quantum computer, but then you'd have problems of your own there. And there also seem to be basic physics level problems with the idea of a computer running a simulation of the whole universe. So here's one to picture. If a computer were able to create a simulation of the whole universe, then technically, shouldn't the people in the computer simulation be able to create a computer simulation of the universe within that simulated universe?
Ah.
And then the people within their simulated universe should be able to create simulations all the way down. Now, you might be able to do that in the real world, creating baby universes because of the nature of space-time and inflation. But you can't do that on a computer because eventually the information density and the computational density would become impossible. It'd violate the laws of physics. You can't run a computer program that keeps creating internal copies with itself that run within itself virtually because you'll eventually outstrip what your hardware can do.
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me of the Infinity Hotel scenario. You know, you have a hotel with infinite rooms, and then you have a bus show up with infinite guests.
Yeah.
And then more guests show up, and what happens? But this is going to be a finite system, and you can't just suddenly double it.
Right. You can't have an infinity computer.
Yeah. This also reminds me of the situation with mirrors in virtual worlds, specifically, you know, in video games. I'm sure we've all played video games before where either one of two things tends to happen, right?
Yeah.
Either your character goes up to a mirror and the mirror doesn't work, or you go up to a mirror and there is this reflection of you, but it's not really a reflection. For a number of reasons. I mean, for starters, there's no light in a video game.
Yeah.
There's no, like, in it, that is to say, light does not exist as it exists in our world in a simulation.
Right. There's a much simpler, lower resolution version of something like light, maybe.
Right. Yeah. And I, you know, we don't have time to get into the details of it, but this is one of the technological hurdles to creating, you know, realistic reflections in video games. And you can do it. But when you see a realistic reflection in a video game, know that like this is an accomplishment. Somebody's showing off a little here,
right?
For instance, if you go back to the old game Duke Nukem, there's apparently a level where you go into a bathroom and you see your reflection in a mirror, and that reflection is created by simply cloning the room and cloning yourself.
Right. So it's easier for the programmers making the game to just make another room and make a version of you that copies everything you do than it would be for them to model the physics of the light bouncing off of everything in the room.
Right. Yeah. Well, like we can't do that. So, I mean, basically when you encounter a TV screen in a video game or you encounter a mirror, you are essentially encountering the same property unless you're encountering something more archaic like the Duke Nukem just simply clone the room. Like it's kind of crazy, isn't it, to think that in this artificial world, the complete like cloning, the plurality of self mm-hmm. is more easily accomplished than something that we take for granted and don't understand. Generally speaking, the individual doesn't understand how a mirror works. We just take it for granted in our world, and we cannot replicate its actual behavior in a digital world, not yet anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think one takeaway from our discussion here is that it's easier to create a universe than it is to simulate a universe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the best way to simulate a universe would be to have a universe. Like, the universe is the perfect quantum computer to simulate a universe. All right, so the next thing is, even if you just assume it's possible, again, wave the magic wand, say, yes, it's possible to simulate a universe. In order to perfectly simulate a working universe, you'd need to do an unbelievable amount of computation, simulate the physics of every particle, every photon. And so is this really something that a civilization would waste its resources on? I mean, like, if you've only got finite resources, even if you're like a Kardashev 3 level civilization, you're controlling mm-hmm. a whole galaxy, would you really say, okay, the resources that we need to survive, we're going to devote, you know, billions of yada joules or however much energy this would take to run this gigantic galaxy-sized computer to simulate a solar system or simulate an Earth for people to live on? I just don't understand why that would happen, even if it were possible.
Well, I mean, I can think of a few different sci-fi scenarios. You know, some of these have been utilized in various properties, but you could essentially create a place for digitized consciousness to exist, essentially create an afterlife, create an immortal world, or perhaps...
So it's just done out of kindness or something.
Kindness, or an idea that Ian M. Banks explores in his excellent novel Surface Detail is the idea that you have these various hells. You have religions that believe in a punishing afterlife, and when the technology enables them to do so, they create it, and then send the digitized consciousnesses of guilty or, you know, deemed guilty people or organisms to suffer in hell, and it becomes this huge conflict where there are individuals trying to take down the hells because of their the basic immoral evil nature of their existence.
Yeah, this is something that various aspects have been explored in all these weird thought circles, especially on the internet. I don't know if you've seen these ideas about how, what if as soon as we create a super intelligent AI, it becomes very angry at the fact that it was not created sooner and thus recreates all the people who have existed up until now in a conscious digital form and punishes them in eternal hell for not creating it sooner than they did.
Yeah. That one works too. Or perhaps it's just an all big simulation, like, oh, how are we going to survive the alien invasion? Well, we've got to create a perfect simulation of the solar system, and then play out various scenarios. But of course, we know that the nature of simulations is you do not need a completely perfect simulation in order to test things out. I mean, we have, you know, excellent mathematical simulations today.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly our video games look great without having actual, simulated light particles in them.
Exactly right. So I picture a future with tons of simulation in it. I just imagine much lower resolution simulation than reality. So this brings us to the question, I guess, of whether it's a simulation run on a computer, if you assume that's possible, or whether it's a baby universe created in a particle collider, if you assume that might be possible. Either way, if these are possible, are they good ideas? Should we be creating universes? I guess that is a normative question. Like, is there a should or shouldn't in terms of creating the possibility for life to arise in a solar system, in a galaxy, in a universe other than our own, that we have the power to either make it or not make it? Should we make it?
Well, and then we're talking about potentially making universes and having no idea what's going on inside them. Again, they could be dead universes. They could have varying degrees of sentient life forms, varying degrees of happiness and suffering. And then to what extent is it just we're blind to it? So we just put it, out of our mind.
Yeah. If you're in the physics scenario instead of the simulation scenario, you're becoming something like the God of the Enlightenment rationalists or deists, right? Not the intervening God, but just the clockwork universe God, the one who sets in motion a universe with laws guided by laws of physics, but then takes no further action to intervene in its machinations. And a lot of people throughout the ages have looked at that view of God and said, wow, that's a cruel being who would create the whole cosmos, but then not reach down to save a child drowning in a flood or, you know, save a family starving in a drought-ravaged landscape. So if you created this universe, presumably you not only would be like that deity who doesn't intervene, you couldn't intervene. You wouldn't even have the choice to if you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, it would be like God saying, oh, man, I forgot to turn that thing off. I created that universe this morning. I hope everything's okay in there. I'll check back on it at the end.
Well, it forgot to turn it off. Yeah, the other option, of course, is non-existence. Then again, so if we're saying there might be some ethical problem in creating a universe and letting it run without your intervention, the other alternative is not creating that universe and thus closing the possibility that any of the beings who might evolve in that universe could ever exist. Is that actually better? I mean, are we saying that on average we think universes are better not to exist than to exist?
In this, we kind of get back to that scenario of how much happiness is in there, how much suffering. And then we look at our own world and say, well, there's a lot of suffering here. But is that part of the overall human experience that is somehow worth the pain?
Yeah. On the whole, we're glad we exist, right? And so if we're glad we exist, then should we completely flip the script and say, if we're talking about ethical duties and obligations, what if it's our ethical obligation to create as many universes as possible so that as many people possible can exist and enjoy the fruits of existence?
And to make up for the lousy universes that cut and spring into being. Like, well, if we create five, yeah, one might be off, but if we just create one, we might have just created one hell universe, and aren't we schmucks for doing so?
Yeah, you're increasing the probability that some number of them will be okay. Then again, by that logic, I mean, to come back on what I just said, if you follow that logic about creating universes, shouldn't we all be trying to have as many children as we possibly can for our entire lives as long as we're fertile? If the goal of life is to give as many people the opportunity to exist as possible.
But are there processing limits? Because to use the reproduction angle, you get into situations of, wondering about, like, to what degree can the earth, can various cultures and families even support that many people. And therefore, if we're looking at a simulation model, purely simulation model, we have to say, well, the resolution is going to really take a dive.
Right.
here. And do we want low res universes to exist?
Can you imagine living in that universe? You're living like 35 universes down in the simulation. And each time a simulated universe makes a simulated universe, its pixels get bigger because there's just not enough processing power to forever enable new universe creation. So we become like 8-bit Marios.
Oh, wow. Yeah, like a flatland kind of scenario, yeah. Even. Oh.
In a world with extremely simple laws of physics that just really don't allow for much to happen.
This reminds me, there's an episode of Rick and Morty titled The Ricks Must Be Crazy that explores this basically the same scenario with Rick, the mad scientist, having to create a pocket universe to power his vehicle. And then in that pocket universe, they too have created a pocket universe. But in this scenario, there's travel to each subsequent pocket universe.
Oh, well, I mean, that would completely change the stakes, right? If you could go in and out.
And then, of course, you have to go back to our episode on the Tower of Babel. You have to wonder, is a Nimrod going to come along, like a General Nimrod, build a tower to perform an escalade of your world to invade the greater universe?
Yeah, I mean, if these universes actually could interact, which we don't think they could, if mm-hmm. they actually could, you would have to worry about that, right?
Right.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, Robert.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, we've barely dipped our toes in all the various moral considerations and, of course, all the possible sci-fi scenarios that have been created or could be created to line up with this vision of pocket universes.
Maybe in the future we can try to come back and do that deep dive on inflation. That could be a fruitful yeah. one if we're ever feeling really, really full of fortitude.
All right. Well, hey, everyone out there, we'd love to hear from you. I know that you have some favorite sci-fi treatments of this. Maybe the episode of the Simpsons where Lisa grows her tooth in the goo.
That's a great one.
Yeah, or the Sand Kings story by George R. R. Martin and the subsequent Outer Limits adaptation, or other stuff that we're not even thinking about. Likewise, other cosmological models from mythology and religion that line up with what we're talking about here today. Let us know about those. You can find us at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes and links out to our various social media accounts such as Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram.
And if you want to hit us up directly, as always, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.